Fellowship Afternoon Sessions, Tech Alex Surratt.
Good afternoon, everyone. Wow, that's a doozy. Check that out. Wait, everyone awake? Anyone who is sleeping is not now. So we have a little bit of a strange afternoon because the gala buses start leaving at 7 p.m. So we want to try and make the most of our speakers' time. And the last meeting before us went a little bit late and is loud as we were trying to be outside. They just weren't getting the picture. So, you know, so what are we going to do? In any case, but we went a little bit over this morning. So that was our punishment. So thank you all for being here. All of you were have had a good day, I hope. Tomorrow morning, we're going to get a longer opportunity to kind of go in and talk about the week that we've had. Usually we try to use these afternoon sessions to do that, but we've had so many speakers come in the afternoon, we haven't had that opportunity. So I wanted to let you know we're going to have that opportunity tomorrow. But for our speakers this afternoon, Steve Conti and John Crane, our ICANN staff, they're two of my colleagues, and they're here to talk to us. What are you here to talk to us about, gents?
I don't know yet.
Okay. You know, I told you that you had to prepare at least 10 minutes beforehand. So go ahead and so are you going to
– So how much time do we have?
So I want to try and let them – too, right? I want to try and let them go by about probably – 5 minutes or 10 minutes to 7, so that they have time. There are other shuttles, by the way. It's not the only shuttle just the first shuttle leaves at 7. So I want to get you out of here before 7, and it is about close to 6:20. So we want to give ample time for questions. And
okay, well, I'd normally say that we're between you and beer, but I heard the gala is dry, so we're between you and water, which is still good because I hear I'm sure the food will be great. How many of you are first time fellows? How many of you seen me speak before? All right, so I'm not going to do the slide sets. So myself and Steve, I'm the Chief SSR Officer, Security, Stability, and Resiliency at ICANN. I run a small group, of which Steve is one, and we look at the security of the identifier systems, domain name system, routing, et cetera, et cetera. And we're short on time. So I'm going to go straight to questions. Who has questions about internet or identifier security, stability, or resiliency, or maybe some of the things we do like training programs? We're the group that do a lot of training programs, and we're also part of a group that does a lot of research. So we can sit here and do slide sets, but does anybody have questions for us? And I'm going to start with the young lady over here. Do you want to use this microphone?
Hibel Tijani, can you start by telling us what aspects of security you are looking at in IPv4 and IPv6 maybe? Like identifier, like resources, the IPs. Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
So IPv6, we're actually not doing a lot at the moment. You know, some of the issues we had in the past were making sure that IPv6 was deployable. So when we look at the ICANN side, it's things like, if I want to use IPv6 in the DNS, for example, because you know those are two, you know, DNS is about translating names. Can you actually do that? If I'm an end user, can I actually put my quad A's, my IP addresses, into the DNS? And if you look around at the registrars, mostly you can now. So these were the things we were kind of looking at. We were looking at things like, if we put quad A's into the root zone, and this was a few years ago, and of course we've done this, what's the effect? What will we break by changing the size of the root zone, which is a DNS file for the TLDs for the internet? What would we break? So we look at things like that. We look at things and say, well, how is this going to change things? If you look at IP version 4, there's two And V6 has one commonality with this, that there are two interesting problems at the moment. One of them is the fact that you cannot authenticate who owns which IP block. So in the routing system, who here plays with routers? I'm very jealous. They took all my enable passwords away years ago. I'm not allowed on routers anymore. But, you know, you can sort of secure between two peers, two people talking. You can use MD5 or some other algorithm to authenticate who you are. You can't do that globally. And there have been multiple attempts to fix that. Secure BGP is one of them. BGP is the routing protocol, so a secure version. And something called RPKI, Routing Protocol Key, no, Routing Public Key Infrastructure. Neither of those have really been that far deployed. So those are the kind of security issues we looked there. The other one is there's something called, they call it a gray market, the emerging market, the IP version 4 market. Right, and you might not think that's a security issue, right? Why is the fact that people are buying and selling IP addresses a security issue? Well, it's not, but it might be a stability issue. What if all of a sudden, for the end users, what if 5 years from now or 2 years from now, addresses become so expensive and so limited that none of you can get them? Right, and in a way that means you can't even do the translation that we do between V4 and V6. Right? Well, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but that's something we've got to look at. Right? And people are starting to study this. About 5 or 6 years ago, we had a workshop that Google hosted that looked at whether or not there would be an emerging market, and we predicted that there would be. And we were looking to see if we could put controls in it. And with some of the best economists in the world, and some great engineering people, we couldn't figure it out. So those are the kind of things we look in the address space. Obviously, the resource depletion of IPv4 is something we've been looking at for years and trying to get people to understand that it really was going to happen. And unfortunately, people never believe you when you tell them the sky is falling until it lands on their head. Right? So we've been saying, IPv4 is running out. IPv4 is going to run out. No, seriously, it's going to run out. Really, soon. And everybody said, yeah, whatever. And then one day IANA, the ICANN block, ran out. So we try and predict these things, and even though people won't listen, you know, so we're really looking at that side of it more than sort of getting down into the nitty-gritty security details. And yeah.
First of all, I think that the RIRs are also looking into the issues of RPKI and IPv6. So where
Absolutely.
Is the border between what ICANN is doing and what RIRs are doing? And secondly, at the beginning, I thought that your group is working at like infrastructure level, but now it seems to be end-to-end operation. Is that correct?
That's we're looking at protocols as well, right? So we're looking at the things that use the identifiers. So the central thing is the identifier system. So those are names and addresses, port numbers, they're all the identifier systems. And yes, the RIRs are, of course, looking at all the things around IP addresses and also, of course, autonomous system numbers. So we work together. I mean, if you're in the European region, I used to work at the RIPE NCC, and they have something there called RIPE Labs, which is a research center within one of the RIRs, and we work very closely with them. In fact, who's heard of the Atlas program, right? So we're one of the sponsors of that program, and Daniel Karenberg, the guy who designed it, he's one of my best friends, so we work on these kind of stuff together. So is there a border? Definitely when you get into sort of the policy realm, but when you get into actually working on real problems, we tend to work together a lot.
Good evening. My name is Usama Tamimi. I'm an ICANN fellow from Palestine. I just have a general concern. Are you guys dealing with security from iCampus perspective? So you are, let's say, focusing on DNS security only, or you are trying to cover much larger scope to have an end-to-end security for the internet?
No, we focus on identifier security, right? So not just DNS.
Okay.
So, but we're not looking at end-to-end security, right? That's that's not us. You know, we're not building security products. We're not. We're not looking deep in other people's infrastructure. We can't, right? That's not our role. Our role, as mandated by our bylaws, like since the day we were founded, is to worry about the security and stability, and we added resiliency because you kind of need that when things really do break, of the identifier systems, of which DNS is one. It's an important one, but it's only one.
Hamza, I'm from Tunisia. I have a question maybe related to end users' security online. My first question is, do you think that end users should use the internet anonymously? And the second question is, what are your recommendations to the threats to the development of Internet of Things?
Okay, so that's two separate questions. So they should be able to have privacy, right? And anonymity, which I can never say because it's such a horrible word.
Anonymity.
Exactly what he said. An anemone, which is the one out of the cartoon with the fish, right? That's a different issue, right? So from one side of me, I say, yes, you should be able to be anonymous. But the other side of me says, well, if you're attacking me, like you're a criminal, you're whatever you are, I don't want you to be able to be anonymous, right? I want law enforcement through due process to have some way of going and finding you, right? Remember, the due process part of that is very important, right? So I myself am conflicted on this because, you know, there are times when I want to be absolutely anonymous. You know, like when I'm watching Facebook from work, I don't want my boss to know it's me just browsing Facebook all day. But, you know, I also understand the other side of the argument. So it's not an easy question. If it was an easy question, we wouldn't be having all these fights, etc. And what was the second part of your question?
Internet of Things.
Part. Oh, the Internet of Things. I have a worry about the Internet of the Things, and that's that they're all very cheap. The devices are cheap. They're not as secure as they should be. But it's... You know, Internet of Things is a marketing term for putting all your devices on the internet, right? Just like cybersecurity is a marketing term. You know, there's lots of marketing terms thrown around. The cloud, they're all marketing terms. So am I worried? I play with devices at home all the time. My light switches I can control from my phone. I've got cameras I can do. You can't do anything of this from outside my house. I can't do it from here, because I'm worried about the security aspects. But within a controlled network, I play with these things all the time. And frankly, most of them are not very well built. But it's new technology. Cars weren't very well built when they first came out. So a lot of this stuff, you know, it's small, it's cheaper. Things will get better. I hope.
To that too, if I could.
Yeah.
Sorry, I got a mic. I think one of the... So the first question you had, you know... Yeah, we work at ICANN, and we have a very narrow and specific focus on what we look at with security, stability, and resiliency. And end-to-end user or end-to-end connectivity is not really within the ICANN remit. But let's be honest, we're all end users, so you know we all have our own personal concerns, and we try to balance that between you know my personal concerns and my work concerns and things like that. So there is some overlap on that, but John hit on the head. We can't really, it's not really where the ICANN remit is. And if we go out of scope of where ICANN should be, then we're in territory that other experts are looking at. And collaborating with them is one thing, and stepping on their toes is another thing. So we try to collaborate with those groups when it's relevant to do so. For the Internet of Things, I think what we're seeing is a period of rapid development of product. And with rapid development, you know, it's driven by the market share more than it is about stability and connectivity and security and all that too. So everybody is so hip and excited about this Internet of Things, and they're ignoring a lot of the albeit old and albeit slow process of proper protocol development through the IETF, which has checksafes for security for protocol development. The people just want to get this stuff out, you know, and it's not, you know, sometimes it's great, you know, there's some good services out there and some good Internet of Things, but going through the process and understanding that if you sidestep some of that stuff, it's going to cause some issues, and the more and more stuff we get on the Internet of Things, it's going to start compounding that. So we're starting to look at it from some aspects. Rick's doing some of the work on the DNS stuff of some of the IoT stuff. We're starting to look at it and see and kind of dip our toes in the pool to see if there is something that's within the ICANN focus, but right now we're just watching it as individuals.
Yeah, and if you look at all of these devices, you know, like a lot of them have DNS servers on. You know, they're all going to need IP addresses. Are those going to be some kind of private IP address? Is it going to be V6? There's a lot of questions that touch us, but it's not because it's this Internet of Things. It's because they're affecting our world. Any more? Which one? You moderate. Okay, who was first?
Okay.
Let's start that end. He's got his microphone on. Go ahead. No, this guy.
Go ahead, right?
Yeah, right at the very end.
All right, thanks. Thanks a lot. I have this clarification to seek from you. Where does the control of the security end when you want to compare with government control? Of course, where the guy can resolve the... I'm not interested in that, dude, but we know what happens when governments choose to control what security happens and on the domain of, I don't know at what point they do that. I give an example. At some point, my country, and I digitalized my name from Nigeria, by the way. At some point, I can't remember what was happening at that time, but that's a very period, within a specific period of time, between 9 a.m. or 12 or thereabout, there was no internet, everything. You can't log on to any domain at all. And phones were blocked. So, well, I'm not talking about a phone anyway, but the internet, you can log on to anything. You can log on to ICANN, you can log on. So, at what point do we see the security is... and by the way, there is a corollary to that effect. The corollary is that the same person that is interested in blocking the website can be interested in compromising the security.
Yeah, so governments do what governments do, right? You're talking about the internet, not the identifier system. Right, so we've had cases where governments have decided to turn off the bandwidth for whatever they've done to cut off access. And if we look at it, we say, well, you know, is there any effect on our ecosystem? Just because something's not working in the country doesn't mean it's not working in the rest of the world, right? So a lot of the time, the DNS and everything for everybody outside that country, completely fine. At least if they built their systems properly. But, you know, governments do what governments do. It's nothing to do with us. Those are national issues, national political issues. We've had cases where things like that happen and people say, I can't turn off this country because press people say whatever they want. But, you know, nothing like that has ever happened. You know, we've never had pressure from governments to take part in that. And I suspect if we did, we'd just go, yeah, go away. You know, governments do what governments do. There's, you know, it's not really our realm. What is interesting is, you know, we have a lot of governments participate in ICANN processes. And when they're here, they all love the internet, you know, well, most of them. And they're saying, you know, this is very important. And then occasionally you see, and it's very occasionally, you see things like this happen where they'll cut access to the internet. Not always on purpose, by the way. I mean, I've seen a couple of times where they've accidentally done these things. So, yeah, it's an interesting topic, but it's not really something that ICANN gets into. The GAC never gets into these kind of things. You know, it's just not our realm.
Okay, thank you. My name is Bram. I wanted to ask on the public trust, issues of the public key infrastructure. What future do you see between the future of the certificate authorities and the use of DNS-based authentication of named entities?
So you're sort of saying, you know, where's DNSSEC going forward, right? It's like anything. You need sort of applications to be built on top of it that people will use. I personally like at some point for DNSSEC to be ubiquitous and that people don't really think about it anymore, right? It's just the DNS is secure. That could take years. The interesting thing is there are things coming along like DANE, which is a area of the IETF, where they're putting services on top of the DNSSEC, if you like, the ability to have your own certificates and then authenticate them in some way. If people start using things like that, and some people are experimenting with it, then having DNSSEC may have more benefits than just the authentication of your answers. And that'll be interesting. And that's starting. The person you need to talk to, I can introduce you, is a gentleman called Dan York from ISOC, who is all about measuring this stuff. We have a gentleman called Richard Lamb, who's also all about measuring this stuff. But ISOC has a lot of details on, you know, how this is growing and are people starting to use DANE and other things that they can put on top of the DNSSEC. If we don't build anything on top of it, if we don't use the tool, then it'll just muddle along. You know, it's the same thing that we had with IP version 6, right? If you don't have a reason to use it, people don't. They stick with what they know. And, you know, the reason was that the sky fell and we ran out of V4, but all the other things that V6 promised never really interested anybody. Yeah, I think you were next.
Thank you. I am interested if you can tell us something about the techniques and tools you employ to ensure the identifier security. So what are the techniques, and if you can enlighten us about that. And for the record, this is Mohammad Shabir from Pakistan.
So the tools are very simple. Obviously, there's research, measuring what's going on out there, looking for differences. But there's also something called threat intelligence, which is basically talking to people, being on security mailing lists, being on all the places where all the issues are talked about. These are basic things. There's nothing major. I mean, we have some labs. For example, we have a lab where we're looking at how packets change as they go through middleware. Things like that, your home routers and firewalls and VPNs, all of these things do stuff to the packets and the identifiers. So we do research. So we have a small research group. And then the other thing we do is we interact with the community. Right? We are constantly talking to people in the security community about what are you seeing. You know, and if there's a threat, they know to call us. So if we look at some of the large botnets that have caused problems on the network, but also like affected the identifier system, you know, they're a threat both because they can be used for DDoSing the system, but also often they register tens of thousands of names into the system that, you know, are only there for nefarious purposes, which we feel is a problem. You know, most of those will come to, we don't find those. That's not our area of expertise. But we do know the people whose area it is, and they know us. So a lot of being on top of the threats and seeing things coming is not about knowing everything yourself. It's about having the right peer groups so that you can actually learn from other people. I saw you. I'll come to you next. Okay, go ahead.
Yep, Hashim Noman from Pakistan. So what are you doing to stop CGNs?
Nothing. Carrier-grade NATs? Nothing. We are watching with bemusement. But whether or not to use
a little bit of shakiness too on it.
Yeah, and a little bit of shakiness. So whether you use a carrier grade NAT or you go with something like V6, right, which would be my preference, is kind of a business decision. Right, so people are looking at this very much from a business perspective. Now, if you're on the side that's wanting to see what's happening for vulnerability detection, looking for bad actors, things like that, this large-scale natting of addresses and the problems associated with logging this are problematic. So my personal worry about carrier-grade NATs is that people will invest going down this path, a lot of money, they're not cheap, and then they won't have, maybe for many years, any incentive to go to V6. Right? And if this comes the default, that all the big ISPs say, well, carrier grade NAT, because it's got all these cool features, is the way we go, for whatever business purpose sense that they've decided this, I worry about the effect on V6 deployment and getting V6 out to the ends, etc. But these are business decisions, so they're really hard to influence.
Just to add to that a little bit too, I think I totally agree with what John just said, but you know, with some of the, when you do CGN and things like that, you and even just plain NAT, you or your device are changing what the packet was meant to be in the first place. So, you know, you're already changing your end-to-end, true end-to-end connectivity just by putting a single NAT in somewhere. And I recognize there's value to it. I've got a home network, I've got NAT, and, you know, I use it. But when you put NAT on NAT on NAT on NAT, then you break it that much more and that much more and that much more. So they're not an ICANN issue, but it is an issue that needs to be looked at. I'm sure there's other people out there who are looking at whether or not it is breaking things and at what level. So if, you know, like John said, it's a business decision. If a ISP decides to use CGN and it breaks their customer base, it's horrible for the customer. I agree, but it's not necessarily affecting the stability or the resiliency of the internet as a whole. So unless for some, you know, bizarre, strange mass hallucination, we decide to put CGN really at the core of the routing, then it really does become the customer's problem or the business's problem when things don't work. And it's not a great answer, but that's kind of where we are.
And you also have to remember that whenever we step into areas that are gray for us, we get shot. Right? We're very much pushed for stay within your bounds. So things like that, they're right in that gray area. So we are involved in discussions because people come to us for our expertise and we want to learn. But it's not going to be anything that ever ICANN would make a policy on or anything like that. It's not in that realm. Did you have a comment on this or a question? You want to do that?
Yeah, so do you know what NAT is? If you have a home router and you have one public IP address, the router turns that into multiple IP addresses. A carrier-grade NAT is that same thing, but at, oddly enough, a carrier-grade. So it's at, you know, a cell phone company or a cable or ISP where they only have, because of V4 depletion and exhaustion, they only have so many public IPs, but they need to serve, you know, 1,000 times the customer base than what they have for public IPs. So they're turning that into a large NAT in the beginning of their network.
And things like you keep the addresses for very short spans of time. Lease times are really short. And, you know, logging that much change is extremely hard, they say.
And size-wise, intensive, too.
Yeah. Okay, this gentleman over in the back, yeah. No, the gentleman in the back, I think.
Yeah, he's the same guy.
Oh, you move forward, okay. Don't move.
Hi, John from Fiji. Talking on DNS security, what are the emerging threats to the DNS? First question, and the second question is, how do you deal with DDoS attacks on DNS servers?
So you answered the first question with the second one. One of the biggest issues, in my opinion, is DDoS. you know, we used to have a lot of problems with things like cache poisoning. There's less of that now through things like, through solutions. You know, you look at these problems, you look for solutions. So, you know, Bind and all the other servers did port randomization to make it harder to guess which port would be used. I'm sorry, if I'm going to get too technical here, it's hard not to on these things. So that sort of got, and then we had DNSSEC on top of that, and the cache poisoning, the lying about DNS names has gone more on the background. There are still ways of doing it. It's, you know, it's not perfect, but it's, as we deploy DNSSEC, et cetera, it's getting better. But DDoS, who here has been DDoSed? Denial of service attack, take your network down. It's really miserable. There's not much you can do about it, right? You provision and provision more, which is expensive, and you have your ISPs upstream provision more, and there's a little bit of filtering you can do. But if somebody really wants to DDoS you, you're just going to be in pain. You've seen really large organizations get DDoS that have the funds, you know, billion-dollar corporations that have the funds to buy infrastructure, and they still get DDoSed. It used to be that we were seeing a very large trend in the growth of the size of the individual DDoSes. And we're still seeing some of that, right? We're seeing, I mean, I've not looked at recent stats, but we have seen DDoSes in the half a terabyte sort of range. Yeah. Who here has half a terabyte of bandwidth to their network? Yeah, nobody, right? So, but now what we're seeing is we're seeing more and more smaller DDoSes. We're seeing them used for different types of criminal activity. A lot of the time it was, some of these big ones were really about political expression and, you know, sort of the, I don't like you, I'm going to take you down sort of thing. But now we're seeing a lot of blackmail and things like that. We're seeing a lot of extortion through crime. With, you know, DDoS, and because of DDoS, botnets, networks of compromised machines, are, to me, they're one of the big problems of the network, and we've not found a good solution. Because even when we know where they are, which there are ways we can do that, I mean, some of the things we look at, we do look at botnets because we think they're a threat. Even if we identify a machine that is compromised and is part of a botnet, there's not really much we can do about it. Yeah, I mean, they're a victim, but we can't even fix their machine because that would be illegal. Right, the criminals can get away with this stuff because they don't care, but you can't actually go in most jurisdictions, go and repair somebody's machine without their explicit consent. So when we did Conficker, which is years ago, we had the IP addresses of millions of machines that were infected, but all we could do is reach out to the ISPs and hopefully they'd go and do something. But we couldn't actually do anything, even though technically we probably could, right, because you know, we had some pretty smart minds in the room, and you sit there and go, you know, if we just did this, we could make the whole thing go away.
But just remember, the owner of the compromised machine isn't the bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, it's your mom.
Yeah, they're not. So, I mean, both morally, you know, and legally, it was like, yeah, it's not the right thing to do. So that's probably the biggest threat, I think, by far. We actually have a document that lists a bunch of various threats to the ecosystem. But many of the threats that when people look at it, they're actually towards the business side of it, not necessarily the actual technology. But DDoS, by far the biggest threat at the moment. Any other
question? Gentleman in the structure?
That's him.
Okay, this is Alaji Cisse from the Gambia, second time fellow. My question, I would like to bring back the issue of Internet of Things. My question is Internet of Things really necessary? Do we need it? Because to me, I don't see any essence for inventing Internet of Things.
Do you have a cell phone?
Yeah. So, okay. Again, my second question is, what are the policies? What are the rules or laws in place to be able to protect people with all the security challenges that we're facing? Because nowadays you don't even need those technical skills to be a hacker, because you have all those tools available online where you can go download for free. So anybody can hack. So what are the policies or rules in place to protect or at least, you know, protect people against or at least save these programs, these softwares from easy access?
It's an open market. There are no real rules. There are laws. There are laws in every country. If you DDoS somebody to extort money from them, that's extortion. That's a crime in that country. The problem is the fact that most things are not in a country. The victim may be in a country, but everything crosses jurisdictions. So there are conventions like the Budapest Convention and other conventions that law enforcement deal with these. These are not ICANN matters, right? We're not law enforcement. We're not governmental. Law enforcement and protection of society is really a government job, and they make the laws. Now, a lot of old laws, i.e. physical laws, you can actually use them for the internet. Crime is crime for most part. There are very few crimes that are really crimes computer to computer. There are very few crimes that are really cyber crimes, right? They're normally crimes against people or against assets. And there's lots of laws to deal with that. Now, it's really hard to teach judges and lawyers and legislators to think like that and to understand these things. The internet's pretty new. So, you know, we've got a long way to go, but that's not ICANN's job, that's government job, and people who advise governments. Do we need the Internet of Things? Well, Steve asked you if you had a phone. That's a thing. It's on the internet. So you need that one piece of Internet of Things.
Yeah, I ask you to think about the Internet of Things as, I think it's just a way to model that before they needed a way to term the fact that now there's now more devices than there are people on the internet. Before there was, you know, you had a computer in a family and, you know, your family of four or family of five would share that single computer. So you had more people who were using the internet than were devices. Now that's shifted. And I think that if you think about the Internet of Things of just as a different way to think about how and what's on the internet, then and take away the marketing aspect of it, then that's really what it is. And so it's just a rapid deployment of more devices that are on the internet.
Yeah, and you can ask the question whether or not you want your light bulb to be able to be controlled by your phone, whether you need that. Need is a big word. You know, you need food, you need water, you need some form of power, probably, although you could probably live without it. So need's a big word. But there's clearly a market. There are clearly good uses for Internet of Things. So at my house, because I'm a geek and I play with these things, if there is a fire, my fire alarms will go off, right? We've all got that, right? But mine are actually connected to the network. So when they go off, what else happens? All of my lights in my house turn orange and come on, because orange is a light band that will go through smoke. If they detect smoke, they can also vacate the house by using the air conditioning system to pull the smoke out. Right? Sometimes things can be more intelligent and useful and actually have life-saving properties when they can talk to each other. It all goes wrong when the security fails. But there are very clear and useful uses of devices that when you connect them, they suddenly gain a whole new life. If you think of a thermostat in a house, how many of you go up to your thermostat and change the temperature every time you think it needs adjusting, right? You go, oh, yeah, I'll just leave it. It'll go down. Or you may go do it once or twice a week or once a day, depending on how hot it is. So it'll be running it lots of times when it doesn't need to. That's wasting energy, right? If you look at some of these learning thermostats that have algorithms that they can then get new ones and they can be programmed remotely, or you can, for example, my thermostat, I can sign up with my electricity company, which I've not because I don't trust them, to a program where when the temperature gets above a certain amount, my air conditioning temperature will be turned up, so I won't be calling as much. Right? That's a real use. If you've got an entire city of people doing that, you're really making a difference to the ecosystem. So need is a big word. I don't think we need any of this thing. We don't need the internet. Right? Need. But boy, is it making life easier. We don't need mobile phones, but they're very convenient. We don't need thermostats that connect to the internet. I've not managed to figure out what the reason for a refrigerator is that connects to the internet, but people tell me there are. Or a toaster, but that the market will drive that. I think a lot of the gadgets will disappear over time, but I think some things will turn out to be extremely useful.
John, the boss said two more questions, but you're chatty, so let's take one more question and let them get out on
time. I'm not chatty, I just like to talk a lot.
But I think, I'm going to take two, we're going to do them short. So we're going to take this gentleman first, and then we'll take that gentleman afterwards, because neither of them have asked.
Yeah, Arun Raje, first-time fellow from India. We are seeing a very big transformation in internet space. We are moving towards Internet of Things. Then IPv6 adoption is going on. So your expert comment on where we think in 10 years where we will be on internet, because now we see that root systems like European open roots systems are coming up, Yeti DNS is coming up. Then you are having anonymous systems keeping up like deep web and dark web. So, and the privacy issues are there. We are having driverless cars, so things are there. So how you feel that after in these 10 years where we are heading towards?
Well, I can't see the future, but I can comment on a couple of them. I'm going to try and keep it quick so this gentleman has a chance. These other alternate DNS systems, if they can figure out a way to make them all communicate, that'd be cool. I don't think they're going to, because we've been saying this for years. If they all go their separate ways, they won't be the internet. There will be internets. And then maybe we won't be able to talk to each other. So we've got to find a way, if we go from internet to internets, to cross those borders. Because I'm not saying it's a bad or a good thing. I personally have problems with it. I like the idea that if I send an email, it always goes to the same place. But maybe there's some technology that can solve that. So people are working on that. No, we don't know where the internet's going to be 10 years from now. New technologies come, new technologies go. Maybe the DNS won't even exist. Right? Who here actually really uses as a human the DNS? Right? We tend to mainly, yeah, me and Steve, we're weird. You tend to mainly use things like search engines and apps, and you know. So it may be there in the background, but it may be unimportant to the actual user. At which point, people will be less greedy and political about it because it won't have as much value. So that may change, but only technology will drive that. I'm going to let this gentleman. And I'm going to let Steve answer whatever question it is.
Ah, okay. Hamad Usama from Morocco. Welcome to Morocco. My question is about your future strategy in your new stability and UNC, and how we can it implemented in the future. And about second information about Internet of Things, we had organized a conference about Internet of Things, and Hamza was with us. It was so interesting. But all human beings don't know why we need this. Is to facilitate our life, or just to be with the new technology? Thanks.
All right, so to answer the first question, ask John. Going back to the Internet of Things, I don't think it's a question of need or wants anymore. I think it's just, you know, if we look at the telephone system, you know, over the past, 100 years, 120 years that it's been around, it's very much kind of like the same internet model where, you know, only a few had it and then more people had it and then suddenly everyone had to have it and now you're carrying it in your pocket. That carrying it in your pocket is kind of the Internet of Things part, you know. So now we have internet and we've had it for 25 years and then more people got it and then businesses decided to sell things on it. And now we're at the point where everything talks on the internet. It's not necessarily a question of us needing or wanting stuff anymore. It's like what John said, his system speaks to other devices, which therefore makes his life better or safer or things like that. So, yeah, they're always going to pitch the whole refrigerator with the TV on it and will automatically call the store for you. And that's not the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things are these tiny little sensors that are working in conjunction to make someone's life better and more convenient. And I think that's just, it's going to naturally happen. It doesn't necessarily need to have a moniker of a label of Internet of Things. It's just, you know, mankind always wants to make them, mankind works hard not to work, right? So that's what we're doing. We're working hard so we don't have to work. And
first question, strategy. When we talked about SSR strategy, we're about to publish a new document. The framework.
Our framework, we have a new framework for SSR. It's going to be published on our website probably within the next month.
Yeah. So we have to publish how we're thinking strategically for the next years, and we do that pretty much every year. We look at what we think the emerging threats are, where we think we need to put our thing. So you have to plan ahead.
And then we ask the community to review that. And so, you know, it's a dual process. We say, this is what we think we're going to be doing, and then we bring it to the community. We're going to have a community review scene. Ask me about reviews. And over the period of the next year and a half, we're going to be having talks with the community-selected committee to determine whether or not, A, that we're doing what we said we were going to do, but, B, that what we're saying that we're going to do in our future strategy is the right thing to be doing.
To the gala, or not.
So, thank you very much. And like with all things, I like to offer up everybody's time, so if you see either of these guys, please stop, ask them questions. And
just look for people with funny hats, and usually us.
So, thank you very much for coming, and everybody to the gala, and enjoy your evening, and I will see you bright and early tomorrow morning, and on time.
Can I, before everyone yes. steps up, last statement.
Oh.
And it has nothing to do with security and stability. It has everything to do with you guys. You guys are really the voice of the internet, and the fact that you're here, that you want to be here and not paid to be here, says worlds. So hold on to that and be what you want to be, and let the internet make the internet what you want it to be, because it's yours. It's ours. And I applaud each of you for being here. So thank you.